Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The Winnemem Wintu people of California, having lived near Mount Shasta along a tributary of the McLeod River for over 10,000 years, celebrate the Balash Chonas, or puberty ceremony, when their girls mature into women. The ceremony celebrated on July 3, 2012 was extraordinary when Balash Chonas was celebrated for the next Winnemem Wintu spiritual leader. However, these ceremonies may come to an end if the United States government continues with a plan to raise the level of the Shasta Dam and flood out many of the Winnemem Wintu's remaining sacred sites. Our guest is Lila Johnston, a Navajo woman, currently a student of race and ethnicity at Stanford University, who is documenting the culture and sacred sites of the Winnemem Wintu people. Christina Onnestad, the assistant producer of Radio Curious, visited with Lila Johnston at the July 3, 2012 Balash Chonas ceremony. They began their conversation when Christina asked Lila how many sacred sites the Winnemem Wintu have along the McLeod River.
There are too many sacred sites along the McLeod River to count. There are hundreds. I've been working with them for a year and a half, and I've only scratched the surface of the intimacy they hold with the land as a society, as an indigenous society. I compiled a list of 56, but I know that this list is incomplete. I think it would take several more years to compile a complete list of all the sacred places that the Winnemem Wintu have.
When you say the Winnemem Wintu have a deep intimacy with the land, what do you mean by that?
Imagine you live in New York City your entire life. You know every street back and front. You see the grid in your mind of the New York City street structure. Now imagine, instead of New York City, you live on the McLeod River for your entire life. You walk up and down the river's edge. And not only that, but your people have been living here for up to 8,000 years, as far as our archaeological methods can tell. You're going to know the McLeod River Basin extremely well. You're going to know every stone, every peak, every mountain. You're going to know, notice the way the geology changes as you walk up the river, the different types of igneous or metamorphic rock that comes up. You're going to know every bend in the river. You're going to know every pool. You're going to know every rock around every bend. This is how the Winnemem Wintu indigenous society is. They've been here for millennia. They understand the river like a family member, and they equate these sacred sites to family members all the time.
In your paper, Chonas Palm, A Place to Dance, you write the Wintu are an ecological ethnicity. What do you mean by that?
Okay, so sometimes our identities are absolutely intertwined with the ecosystem. Sometimes they're not. If you take suburban American culture, for example, there's nothing in our identity that really depends upon a river or a mountain. Maybe it does indirectly, but a lot of times our ethnicities actually depend upon the destruction of the environment, like our diet, our fast food culture diet depends upon the destruction of ecosystems. When it comes to the Winnemem Wintu, I've used the term ecological ethnicity because their identity, their culture, their social, economic, medicinal, spiritual practices are absolutely intertwined with the environment here. In other words, if you were to destroy the environment, their culture would also be destroyed. It is an absolutely interdependent relationship, and one cannot really survive without the other.
So let's talk about the interdependence. In your paper, you emphasize 7 sacred sites to the Winnemem-Wintu that are threatened by the proposal to raise the Shasta Dam.
Right. There are 51 sites that I've tallied that will be seasonally or permanently inundated or otherwise affected by a 20.5-foot dam raise in the Shasta Reservoir. 36 of these sites will be flooded out. I've chosen to focus on 7 of the sacred sites for the book that I'm writing. Really long, elaborate chapters about how this culture hinges upon a stone, upon a pool. For example, we have here right now the Bathas Chonas, which means the sacred dance of her first menstruation, is one translation you could have. And it's a ceremony they have when a young girl becomes a young woman, when she receives her first menstruation. And the centerpiece of this ceremony is Bathas Son. Son means rock, so the rock of her first menstruation. And if you look on this rock, there is deep indentations from centuries of use by Winnemem-Wintu women grinding acorns and grinding herbs in the manner that she is doing right now.
So the Bathas Son, the puberty rock, the menstruation rock, is a sacred object. How?
Well, the Winnemem-Wintu have these stories about how the ancient ones were here, and instead of moving on to the next world, they chose to stay behind. They chose to remain on the McLeod River to help the people, and they hardened into stone. And so a lot of these sacred places are people to them, ancestors to them. Not just any ancestors, but ancestors that love them with all their hearts and wish to help them. And so Bathas Son, of all the thousands of rocks on the McLeod River, is the rock that was calling out to them that they might use it for this purpose, to initiate the young girl into the young woman. And so if you look upon this stone, there are deep, deep indentations, maybe 3 inches deep, because women have been going to that stone that has that spirit and that power and that intention to help the Winnemem-Wintu. They go there because that stone has a blessing for them. And its blessing is for the birth of young women. And they grind their acorns there and their teas there, because as a young Winnemem-Wintu woman, you need to know how to feed your people and you need to know how to help them when they're sick. So she's grinding her acorns for the acorn soup, and she's grinding her teas to help for, you know, basic Winnemem-Wintu first aid is what she's learning over there right now. And it's what women have been learning right there for centuries. They've been doing what she's doing for a very, very long time. And it's quite beautiful, their culture. And it goes to show how deeply culture can be embedded in the land. Because if that rock goes, there's nowhere else that they know to do this ceremony. That's the only place that a Winnemem-Wintu girl becomes a Winnemem-Wintu woman. There, I've witnessed 4 different womanhood ceremonies, the Diné, the Lakota, the Apache, and this one. But none of them have the quality of the Winnemem-Wintu version, the quality of profound site specificity, profound earthbound nature. You can't have this ceremony anywhere else in the world. If you do, it is not a Winnemem-Wintu ceremony. It's something else.
You write in your report that a lot of what makes a Winnemem-Wintu person a Winnemem is what they do. not what they say. And of course, in order to do anything, we must be somewhere. So it happens that much of what Winnemem people do to remain in alignment with their values and traditions must be done in specific places. Mm-hmm. It's clearly a site-specific or earthbound culture. Mm-hmm. How does that differ from other cultures?
Okay.
Let's say even American culture.
Yeah, let's take an example from American culture. What is a major pillar of American culture? Well, one thing is our literature. A figurehead of that might be Mark Twain. Mark Twain is a huge figure within American culture. Now, can you read Mark Twain in Mississippi? Yes. Anywhere in the world, you can learn about American culture through the lens of literature. Winnemem Wintu culture is different because it's not something that's written or something that's thought or something that's broadcasted on television all over the world. It's something that is experienced. I called the paper Chonas Poem because this means a place to dance. This is the dance of culture. It is something that is done. And while reading a book is something that is done, you can do that anywhere in the world. You cannot dance the Winnemem dance anywhere else but here. And so it's really an embodied culture. A lot of what makes someone Winnemem Wintu is the sites that they physically go to. The Winnemem Wintu have an amazing enrollment policy. You don't have to be one quarter Winnemem blood or 1/16. They don't care about your blood quantum. They care about, do you know where the sacred sites are? Do you know what they do for the people? Have you been to them? Have you spoken to them? Have you prayed to them? Have they spoken to you? Have they told you how to be Winnemem Wintu? How to heal your people? Do you know how to dance right here on the McLeod River? Do you know what the sacred sites are called? So these are things that make Winnemem Wintu Winnemem Wintu. And there's people, they have even Japanese people as members, full members of their tribe, because they know all of these things. And so their cultural definition of Winnemem Wintu is, have you been to the McLeod River? Do you understand it?
In this edition of Radio Curious, our assistant producer, Christina Onnestad, is visiting with Lila Johnston, a student of race and ethnicity at Stanford University, who is researching the culture and sacred sites of the Winnemem Wintu people.
There's another sacred site that you write about called the Suckerfish Pool.
Right.
Or Achimem.
Achimem, yeah.
Can you tell us about it?
Absolutely. The Suckerfish Pool is one of their central sacred sites. This teaches us so much about Winnemem Wintu culture. One thing is, a lot of these sites are spirit dwellings. There's Suckerfish Pool, there's Eagle Rock, there's Red-Tail Hawk Rock, there's the mountains where the grizzly bear spirit lives, there's the rock where the coyote spirit lives. All of these places anchor in an animal spirit, or not all of them, but animal spirits are anchored into the land.
So what's the significance of an animal spirit?
These are acquaintances in the spiritual world. A Winnemem Wintu doctor trains for decades to meet these spiritual beings in the spiritual realm and employ them during doctoring sessions.
Do different spirits have different purposes or strengths?
Well, first of all, in the Winnemem world and in reality, spirits are people like you and I. They have free will. They have an intention of their own. So it's really up to them. Coyote Rock isn't used for any healings. That's actually sort of the trickster rock, the dark rock. Suckerfish is one of the primary doctoring spirits of the Winnemem Wintu. And it helps anything from psychological disease to physical illness to emotional abuse. It handles, it's sort of an all-around doctor. Things like Eagle Rock, I believe, are more just blessing spirits. You don't call them into a doctoring session the way you would Suckerfish. But another really interesting thing about Sucker Pool is it shows us how interconnected the sacred sites are. When a person is fasting, they'll visit this site. But before they do, they'll visit five other sites on the way up to the mountain here, where they'll sit in the sun for as many days as they need to receive the prayer, the answer to the prayer. And then they'll come back down, visiting all those sites along the way, again, back down to Suckerfish Pool. And that's where they will end the fasting ritual. And so these sites are used in conjunction. And I've heard the Winnemem joke about them being like cell phone towers, how they amplify prayers, how they are bases to speak with the Creator.
And how are these sites used medicinally? Specifically Suckerfish Pool, we'll say, since we're talking about that in particular.
Well, when you finish your fast, you dive down to the bottom of the pool and you get a stone and you bring it back home. And as you're swimming across, you're supposed to take as much time as you can so the sucker spirit can take a good look at you, kind of size you up. And if you're a good person, he'll let you come back up. But you go down, you get that rock. And that stone, like in many cultures, is used to hold healing energy. And all of these places hold a sort of healing energy. In Japanese, it's called Reiki. In Lakota, it's called Shika. In Christian medicine, it's called the Holy Spirit. But it's this type of energy that can work with the body. And acupuncturists call it qi. But it's a means of rectifying that energetic body. And in Winnemem Wintu medicine, all things are spiritual. If you have a disease, it's because of a spiritual imbalance. So that way they don't need scalpels, they don't need pills or anything. What they need to do is connect with the spiritual body, heal that, and then that will have positive repercussions on the physical body.
In your paper, you talk about how the raising of Shasta Dam would disrupt and endanger an already endangered culture, yet you don't use the term genocide. I'm wondering why.
Genocide is the extinguishing of a certain genetic stock. And we're not really murdering people here. What we're murdering is their way of life. And so perhaps, from my perspective, a more accurate term would be ethnocide, which is the destruction or extinguishing of culture. Because what happens to the McLeod River happens to the Winnemem Wintu people. And so this does have really adverse health effects and could actually lead to shortened lifespan, but it's not really killing anyone. What it's killing is their culture. And so I think it's really ethnocide that's occurring here with every meter that the Shasta Dam is raised accounts for a form of ethnocide.
In your paper, you write, "I learned how deeply a person can love a stone, a pool of water, or a mountain, and why." What do you mean by that?
The Winnemem Wintu don't see a stone. They see a grandmother. They don't see a pool of water. They see a brother. The Winnemem Wintu interact with these places in a very intimate way. There are places that they visit all year round. There's a rock that is designated to heal children. Every time I walked past that rock, there are children on it. And I keep asking the Winnemem Wintu, how would it affect your culture if children's rock was lost to the dam race? And one participant responded, "Lila, how do you measure the death of a family member? Because that's what it would be." And I am at a loss for words sometimes. I don't know how you measure death of family member. They say, well, we'll get over it the way you get over your mother dying or your brother dying. But I'm not really sure if that's right. It's got down to a matter of human rights here, because we're not only taking away stones and pools that are really important to the Winnemem Wintu, we're taking away their ability to heal themselves in a traditional way. We're taking away their ability to connect with their higher power, their creator, in the way that they have been for millennia. We're taking away their connection to the earth in a place where their culture has been evolving for at least 8,000 years. And so that's how deeply someone can love a stone. And really, I don't know if there's any cultures quite like the Winnemem Wintu that have such deep relationships with the geography of the area. I mean, I know there are, but not quite to this extent. They really have names for every place along this river. You can look at this river and you see, oh, there's trees, a river, and rocks. But they don't see that. They see a whole map of sacred sites that connect with each other, are used in conjunction with each other, are visited when your relatives are sick. They see something different when they look at this river than maybe you or I do.
Okay. Well, Lila, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
You're welcome.
I have a few questions about you.
Okay.
You're of Diné ancestry.
Yeah.
Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
Why anthropology, and what got you interested in the Winnemem Wintu?
When my grandmother was in boarding school, they would not let her speak her language. In fact, when she did speak Diné Bizad, the Navajo language, they would punish her and tell her to write 100 times, "I will only speak English." There's been a campaign against these healing societies since 1492. We're being assimilated and forgotten at an alarming rate. A language disappears every week. The Winnemem Wintu are such an extraordinary, beautiful people. I could not stand to let this very fragile and magnificent culture fall through the cracks. So as an Indigenous person, I feel really happy to be able to record and articulate the beauty of culture. And so it's a little different than traditional anthropology, which is done maybe to become a professor or get tenure or write a book or participate in a scholarly discussion. This is really about the people that I'm working with. It's really about them as much as I can make it be. And a lot of what I'm writing isn't for me or for you. It's for the future generations of the Winnemem Wintu, who might, you know, have all these 51 sites destroyed because of the dam raise and wonder who they are and have no idea who they are. And at the very least, we can say, well, this is who you were. And I don't think that's going to happen. I think there's too much beauty here to have this dam raise go up. That's what drew me to them, was how on the brink this culture is and how sad it is to see people be thrown to the wayside, especially when they have very important lessons for the world right now about how to relate with the environment, about how to heal each other without Western medicine that is very full of side effects and symptoms and symptom-based medicine. And so I really just want to document this culture in a very sensitive way and respectful way.
So that leads me into a couple other questions. One is, can you describe an aha or eureka moment in your life, like where you had an epiphany?
Mm-hmm. When I was 14 years old, I had my first menstruation. Sometimes when this happens in American society, we simply hand the girl a tampon and tell her to be quiet. But that's not the way it was for me. As a Navajo woman, as a Diné woman, my entire family gathered for hundreds of miles around to this beautiful place in the desert. And we had a kinafta, the traditional womanhood ceremony and celebration, just for me. And all of my relatives came together and prayed for me for 4 days. And I learned so much. I ground corn in the traditional way between stones. I learned how to butcher a sheep. I learned parts of my language. I learned what it means to be a Navajo woman. But most of all, I learned that I was loved. And I know that that had a profound effect on my life and gave me the support I needed to be where I am today. And so the beauty of that culture, I guess that sort of alternative healing culture that I was a part of, these are the things that will be lost, is a way to usher in a brand new born woman into the world with respect. And that will heal her. It will heal the women of our society. And since the women are the backbone of our culture, it will heal all of us. And so that was kind of an aha moment for me, was just to realize how beautiful these indigenous cultures are and how helpful they are for the whole world, really.
And what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I give it to the Creator. I serve the Creator. And so I don't know what I'll be doing, but I leave it to the Creator to guide me and bring me wherever I need to be to make the most help happen.
All right. And can you recommend a book that you've read to our listeners?
The Red Tent by Anita Diamante. Excellent book about Jewish womanhood ceremony. It's a feminist account of Jewish culture, ancient Jewish culture, and how they used to bring their young women into adulthood. It's 300 pages of pure poetry. It's absolutely beautiful.
All right, Lila Johnston, thanks for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much. Appreciate being here.
Lila Johnston is a Navajo woman, currently a student of race and ethnicity at Stanford University, who is documenting the culture and sacred sites of the Winnemem Wintu people. The book she recommends is The Red Tent by Anita Diamante. This interview, hosted by Radio Curious assistant producer Christina Onnestad, was recorded at a Winnemem Wintu puberty ceremony overlooking the McLeod River in Northern California on July 3rd, 2012. Over 400 Radio Curious programs may be found on our website, radiocurious.org. They're free as my gift to you. I hope you enjoy them. Email is curious@radiocurious.org. Christina Onnestad is our assistant producer. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.